I think going back to the old days, metrics you were looking at, again, being in a more technical organization and being in IT, it's you're looking at the technical things that you are doing. Like, how many workstations have up-to-date security definitions in your antivirus, right? Like, how many things did we block at the firewall today? How many spam messages made it through? Things like that. And while those are interesting data points, it really doesn't tell you what risk is and how those things relate to risk. So I think, part of it, you have to take it up another level from there.
Welcome back to the Defenders Advantage podcast. I'm Carrie Matry, host of the Frontline Stories series. And today, I'm joined by Alex Wood, the CISO of Uplight. So welcome, Alex.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about your company, your past experience as a CISO.
Yeah, happy to. So Alex Wood, I am the Chief Information Security Officer for Uplight. Uplight is a software company, and we play sort of in the clean energy space. We help power companies to help decarbonize the grid. It's a pretty cool company. I've only been there a few months, but really enjoying it. Part of that also is that we're a B Corp, so we have a cool corporate mission as part of the company, and it's one of the reasons that attracted me there. But that's what I'm doing now. But I've been in security for an awfully long time, as you know, and kind of made it my living and been enjoying doing that.
Excellent. And before this role, you were over at the Anschutz organization. What were you doing there?
So I've had a couple different roles. Most recently, I was the Chief Information Security Officer at the Anschutz Corporation. And they are a holding company. And so I was overseeing the security programs at the companies in their portfolio there. So sort of more oversight and governance, more like a CISO of CISOs there. There were companies that had their own security teams, and we were just making sure that they were doing what they needed to do. Before that, I've been in financial services and healthcare, IT, telecom, oil and gas, lots of different industries. One of the nice things about security is, it kind of cuts across all industries. So I think it's a little bit easier to jump around than some folks that might be more industry focused.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, you've touched almost all of the industries, seen a lot of things. So you've been a CISO for how long?
My first security leadership job, I think, was like 2012. So 10-ish years now doing that. And, prior to that, more on the technical side and some program management and other things like that. But kind of came up more through the technical ranks, and then decided at some point it was time to make the move over into security leadership and try and lead security programs.
So having been in CISO security leadership roles for a decade, having been in cybersecurity for a couple more years than that, a long time, how have you seen the role of the CISO change?
Yeah, I think it's grown and evolved. When I first started in security, it was, everything was very technical, and security was definitely, part of IT, and it was, that was really what you were dealing with, just the technical aspects of security. And as security has kind of grown up too, it's become, more of a business function, a risk management function. And I think the role of security leaders has changed too. It used to be that the highest level security person might have reported to a director in the IT organization, which was 2, 3, 4, 5 levels down from the CEO. And now many times the CISO is reporting to either general counsel or COO, or maybe even in some cases directly to the CEO, and has a much more business focused role as part of the company and really working towards the risk management of the company, not just security.
Not just firewalls.
Not just firewalls. Exactly.
Right. And so who do you report through in your current role?
Yeah, I currently report to general counsel, which I think is a pretty good place for security leaders to report to. Although I don't think that there is any perfect place, but legal is functionally a risk management organization as well, and so I think having security in that organization helps with that. Most lawyers understand risk management and that sort of thing. They might not understand the details of security risk management, but that's what our job is, to help them understand that piece of it.
Yeah, I mean, do they come in with some basic understanding of security, or are they totally risk focused and your job is really to bridge that gap for them and kind of educate them on security risk?
Yeah, I think it depends. You know, I've a couple times now reported to general counsel, and there have been different levels. You know, some of the folks that I've reported to have had very little understanding of security, and it's been my job to make sure that they understand, you know, all the intricacies and what it is that we need to do to reduce the risk around that. And others have been much more adept at understanding the issues and understanding security. Not that I don't still play a role there, but you know, a little bit easier in the translation, maybe less storytelling, less explaining, other things like that.
It's good to see other functions of the business kind of recognize security and you know, educate themselves. So, you know, back in the day when we started, almost always a CISO reported up through IT, which made them, you know, like you said, technical focused, and the role of the IT organization was to keep things up and running. And so not necessarily the same as, hey, wait right. a second, stop, put this firewall in place to slow you down. So reporting to general counsel, like, how does that change your mindset? How does that change the goals of the organization? Because it's not just uptime anymore. So what's the goal of general counsel?
Yeah, and I think it causes some positives and it causes some negatives, but also it just means that you have to partner more with different parts of the organization. And I think even previously, when I reported through an IT organization, you know, there were still other aspects of the business that I had to deal with, and so it was similar problems with those aspects where I had to partner with maybe, you know, HR on provisioning and deprovisioning processes, right? Like you got to know who the people are that are working there so that you can make sure that they're either in or not in the systems that you guys have or other functions like that. But being sort of outside of IT, you're not necessarily bound to the same budgets that they have. So I've been in roles before too, where, okay, well, you know, we have this certain budget we need to hit in IT, and here's all these IT projects that we need to do. Oh, and sorry, that's taking up, you know, 99% of the budget that we have. Security, you can have what's left over. You know, make sure with the meager resources that you have, you still get done all the stuff that we've expected you to get done. You know, versus being outside of that organization, we can partner with them, and, you know, there are some responsibilities on us, and then we can also push some of those responsibilities back to the operational parts, back to IT, and say, okay, hey, you know, you're required to do these things, so make sure that you are budgeting for this accordingly, and it's not rolling downhill to us to try and make sure that we're pulling all the things together when we don't have any money or resources or people to get it done.
Yeah, I remember back in the day, you had your IT budget, and then your security budget was maybe 1 or 2% of that.
Yep.
And it was static for the whole year. And so now with, you know, dynamic, everything's changing all the time now. So how do you do kind of your budgeting cycles, your planning? How does that work now?
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's similar in some regards, but, you know, we also, you know, we operate sort of risk first. And as part of that, you know, we're constantly looking at the risks that we have affecting our organization. And, you know, we have a cross-functional, and this has been the same in many places that I've been, you know, cross-functional risk management function, where, you know, we're bringing together people from different parts of the organization to talk about the risks that we have and make sure that they are being addressed appropriately. And if something new pops up in the middle of the year, and, you know, it's decided that this is a big enough risk that we need to tackle it now instead of waiting till later to get funding for it, then, you know, we go to our management or we go to the board or whoever it is that needs to approve it to say, hey, look, this is a serious risk to our business and we need to put some money and some resources into it now. And I don't think that's any different than any other risk to the organization, right? Like if you had some legal or contractual or customer related risk and, you know, it bubbled up to be high enough, then I'm sure the business is going to say, yeah, that's a risk we need to deal with. Let's deal with it now and put some effort into that instead of, you know, waiting till the next budget cycle.
Yeah. So kind of saying what it is we need, what's the risk, what it is we need, and why now instead of later, because everybody's going to always want to kick the can to the next quarter and say, we can do that later.
Exactly. And I think that it's part of it too, is making sure that you're explaining whatever risk it is, you know, in similar ways to other risks and making sure that they're sort of level. You don't want to be chicken little, you know, the sky is falling all the time, but if there is something that truly is a risk to the organization, you got to make sure that people understand that and why it is that we need to fix it.
So if you're totally focused around risk, you're getting your budget for risk, how does that change the metrics you report on? Because, you know, back in the day, if you're reporting up through an IT organization, then it's very technical, tactical reporting. So now how does that change what sort of metrics you bring to the executives?
Yeah, I think going back to the old days, it was your metrics you were looking at, again, being in a more technical organization and being in IT, it's you're looking at the technical things that you are doing, right? Like, did you know how many workstations have up-to-date security definitions in your antivirus, right? Like, how many things did we block at the firewall today? How many spam messages made it through? Things like that. And while those are interesting data points, it really doesn't tell you what risk is and how those things relate to risk. So I think, you know, part of it, you have to take it up another level from there. But then you also have to be good at articulating what the risks are and then thinking about, okay, for this risk, what is going to tell me, you know, what the magnitude of this risk is? You know, say if my e-commerce site is ransomware and is no longer online, right? So let's think about, you know, how likely it is, and then you're going to have to dig into, you know, the technical and the vulnerabilities and things that you have, but that's not going to be important in terms of reporting that up. And then if this does happen, you know, what's the impact to us? You know, how much money are we going to lose per minute, hour, day, whatever the site is no longer there. And, you know, then based on that, I think you have a much better picture of what that risk really looks like. And, you know, you can also associate the controls that you have with those risks to help show how likely it is that this sort of thing would happen. Look, we have all these controls in place. Are they good? Are they bad? How are they performing? And lead that into the likelihood discussion around risk.
Yeah, this is one of the places that I've seen the most growth over the last 20 years is we're no longer reporting on, you know, statistics. How many alerts did we have today? How many tickets did we close? Like, right. That's, to me, that's reporting.
Right.
Where metrics are things that can actually drive change.
Exactly.
So, you know, it's the so what. It's the up-leveling like you were talking about. Like, what is this actually going to mean? So that you know the so what, so that you can drive an action. Yeah, that's something I've seen change a lot over the years.
I think also with that too, you know, we're kind of at a pivotal point right now where there are a lot of factors at play where security is being taken more seriously, whether it's through SEC guidance that you have to have cybersecurity in your organization and, you know, board members with that and other things like that. There's lots of emphasis being placed on security. And I think, you know, we're sort of at a pivotal point where we need to make sure that we grow up and that we are talking in this way instead of in the firewall blocks and things like that. So that, you know, as we have this opportunity to be taken seriously, we show that really we are somebody to be taken seriously.
Yep. You understand the business and how this is going to affect it. Yeah. Well, you know, you and I kind of started in cybersecurity around the same time. And I remember when I first started, I looked at the CISO role and thought, oh no, that looks stressful. That looks terrible. I would never want that job. It's thankless if you're doing it right. If you're doing it wrong, bad things happen. And then Target happens. You know, I've heard people describe cybersecurity as before Target and after Target, because the Target breach is when we first started to see executives lose their jobs over breaches. So then, you know, to me, I said, oh, I'm going to move myself even further away from wanting a CISO job. You went the other way. You said, no, that looks great. I want to jump right in. So why, or how has, you know, the change of executives actually facing real consequences for breaches, how has that changed your approach to the job?
Yeah, I think there definitely is risk there, but I think that there's also reward, right? I got to a certain point in my career, and you and I have both worked at large companies, and I felt like, one, you know, it was hard as an individual contributor to make a real difference, right? And I felt like I had the ability that I could make a difference if I went somewhere and became a leader and had more control over some of the things that were going on. I think it was still going to be hard at that point, because I think of some of the legacy structures. You know, my first security leader job, I was the highest security person in the organization, but I was, I think, manager of cybersecurity, and I reported to an IT director who reported to our CIO. And, you know, so it was still less impact, but I think, you know, some of it is, as I'll put on myself for doing a good job and moving up, but also just, you know, as the industry coincidentally, that I think that the role has more power now than it used to. And I think that is something that's great. And I think is helpful for security leaders and makes it more attractive, right? You never want to be in a role where you have a lot of accountability and responsibility, but no real power to do anything. And I think that's changed. So I think your view of looking at a CISO and saying, oh, I never want to do that, I think that was probably true too, right? Like the people that were doing it at that time, it really was a completely thankless job. You were shouting at the sky saying, hey, there's stuff we need to pay attention to, and no one was paying attention to it. And I think it's been good that's changed a bit. And, you know, there is more ability for CISOs to make change. And that's really what excites me, is the ability to help whatever organization I'm with really get better and move forward and not just be a button pusher or a scapegoat or whatever.
Right. Well, and you seem much happier than you see so in the beginning of our careers. So it seems like, you know, the goal is not to be responding to fires, and you seem like you're doing a good job of that.
Exactly.
So, okay. In your career, what's the coolest thing you've experienced?
You know, in our prep work for this, I put some thought into it, and I really couldn't think of a single sort of incident. You know, I never spent a lot of time as an incident responder or a forensics person or, you know, somebody like that, where it's, you know, oh, I've got really cool stories of this hack or, you know, responding to this breach or things like that. And, you know, I definitely have peers who have those stories. So I don't know if that means that, you know, I've just been successful or I'm boring or what it means. But, you know, I think in general, the coolest thing that I've seen in security is just the way that we have, you know, a great community and how people support each other. And as part of that, just, you know, seeing people that I have worked with or that have worked for me, you know, grow and be part of that community and be great contributors and help move our industry forward.
Yeah, I know the community is a big thing for you. So you co-founded a group called Colorado Equal Security. So tell us a little bit about that and that community.
Yeah, it's funny. I think sort of in my career, I wouldn't be where I am today without community and, you know, the different groups and people within the security community. When I was trying to make my pivot from being an individual contributor and kind of moving outside of what I'd done before, I thought, okay, well, I'm probably going to have to change companies, and I don't really know many people in our community outside of this company. So I volunteered for ISSA. Many people are familiar with ISSA, you know, Professional Association for Security People. And when I did, I said, hey, how can I help? And they said, oh, well, we need someone to help organize this this conference that we put together, the Rocky Mountain Information Security Conference. I said, oh, okay, that's great. I'm happy to help. And the president of the chapter sent an email to the organizing committee and copied me and said, hey, this is Alex. He's our new chair of the conference. And I said, okay. I guess that's what I'm doing. So I got put in charge of the conference because there weren't really any other volunteers at the time. And that led to me joining the ISSA board and some other things. And that really helped me understand the community, find people in the community. It also gave me a sort of a standing that I wouldn't have had otherwise. People say, oh, hey, you're a leader in this chapter. You must be important. And, you know, you get sort of a respect because of that, which has been great. And it also helps me and, you know, improve my communication skills and other things like that. Sort of fast forward and back to your question. One of the things that I realized while doing that was, you know, ISSA is great, but there's all these other organizations, there's all these other groups and people in the community that are doing good things. And, you know, I've always been focused on Colorado, being here in Colorado. And me, along with a partner of mine, we decided, okay, well, let's form a what we call a movement, because it's not an official organization, that's really going to highlight the great community that we have here in Colorado and help to promote that and move that forward. So we started Colorado Equal Security. And we did that a couple of ways. We started a podcast. So we did a weekly podcast with news and interviews for almost 5 years. And we finally realized that weekly was probably a little bit too much for us. So now we do it monthly, but still doing great there. We have a community Slack workspace with a couple thousand people in it, which is really vibrant and lots of discussion that's going on there. You know, we've got a community event calendar to track all the things that are going on. And it's really been a cool movement to see that, you know, people picking up on it. And we actually just had our first community-wide event a month or so ago. You know, through the pandemic, obviously people couldn't get together in person. And we thought, okay, now that people are getting back together, what should we do? And we just had a picnic and we got probably 100 folks to just come out and see each other and hang out and bring their families. And it was a whole lot of fun, but it's been really fun to see that. And, you know, it's helped me to get to know a lot of people in the community. And I think connect people and just, you know, help move everything around security in Colorado forward.
Yeah. And I like the fact that, you know, your mission is Colorado focused. It's not trying to create another gigantic movement or organization that covers the entire world. It's like, no, we're going to focus on this community. So I really like that. And, you know, as you said, just putting this together helped you accelerate your career and kind of build your community. And that's really what we need people just starting to get into cybersecurity to do. They need these sorts of opportunities.
Yeah.
So for people, you know, we ask this question all the time, but for people just getting out of college, how do they get started? Besides, you know, joining a community like this, but how do they get their career started?
Yeah, it's tough right now because I think we have a little bit of a paradox. You know, there's been these surveys for the past, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years that say, oh, you know, we're short 100,000 people in security, you know, 500,000 people. There's a million jobs that need to be filled in security. You know, whatever the number is, it keeps getting bigger. And we've now started to churn out people either from boot camps or community colleges or four-year colleges that have security degrees. Yet when those folks get out of school and try and get a job, it's been hard for them to get jobs because, you know, the quote entry-level jobs that we have in security still require experience. So most of the time, even though it's entry level, you still want someone to have had some experience in security before. So it's tough for those folks. They get out and you've got this big group of people now that are looking for work. And we have our expectations set incorrectly that as they come out, we're going to have these seasoned professionals that that are ready to go. And it's people with a base level of knowledge and some of them are great, but they don't have any practical experience yet. And so we as an industry, we need to change that and make sure that we're offering, whether it's internships to give people some practical experience. I've seen some people trying to do apprenticeships, which I think is even better. You know, you get to work while you're in school and get some practical experience, or true entry-level jobs, right? I think that there's plenty of opportunity to hire people with, you know, zero on-paper experience and that are hungry and ready to learn. And, you know, you can put a little training in and some time with them and they're going to be valuable members of your team and probably go on to be valuable members of the community too. But we really need to adjust our expectations first. And I've been trying to do that when I hire entry-level jobs, really looking for people that may not have had experience before, but really are passionate and want to get into the industry.
Yeah. And I think the industry needs to roll up their sleeves, as you're saying, of let's think differently about what roles we need to hire for. Because if we have 10 roles that we need to hire for that we can't fill, we're doing a disservice to our organizations. So how do we shift what the actual roles are so that we can fill them and grow people into what, you know, the ideal state is?
Yeah. And I think it's going to be hard for a little bit too, because there are going to be those roles still where you need a certain experience, right? Like, hey, I'm trying to hire a, you know, cloud security person that they have to have, you know, XYZ experience in AWS or Azure or GCP, right? And for that particular role, yeah, you're going to need somebody that's experienced and it's going to be hard to find them because those roles are short now. But I think for a lot of the stuff that we need, it could be entry-level people and we just really need to focus on that and build up people with those skills so that down the line, we are going to have more of those people that can fill those more experienced roles.
Yeah, I think all of us didn't come in with the experience we needed for our jobs. I mean, how did you get into the industry?
Yeah, so I didn't go to school for computer science and definitely not for security because that didn't, those degrees didn't exist, you know, way back in the Stone Ages. And, you know, I got a degree in chemistry. And then, you know, as I was getting out of school, I realized, you know, maybe chemistry is not what I want to do with the rest of my life. It was, you know, this has been fun, but maybe I need to move on. I'd always had an interest in computers. My on-campus job during college when they still had computer labs was to be one of the people that was in the computer labs helping people. You know, hey, you're using WordPerfect trying to write your term paper, but you don't know how to do the formatting or, you know, things like that. And so I would help people in computer labs. So I had a little bit of experience that way. And I had worked for my uncle for a few summers he owned a software business. And so I had helped him in his business. And so when I got out of school, I moved out to Colorado and I was like, okay, I guess I'm going to need a job. I'm not sure exactly what. And so I started looking around and thinking, okay, well, I have some computer skills. Maybe I can get an entry-level computer job. And it was the late 90s and, you know, kind of the dot-com boom at that time. And I think for a lot of places, if you could type on a keyboard and say a few coherent sentences about computers, you'd get hired for something. So I got an IT help desk job and did that for a few years. And then one of the guys that I was with, you know, he moved over to a different group at the company where I was, and it was a security group, and he was going to be a pen tester. And I like, it was the craziest thing I'd ever heard of. Like, that you're going to this group and they're going to pay you to break into stuff, right? Like, is that even real? And so I thought, wow, that sounds like it's a cool thing. So I kind of kept my eye open for jobs in that group. And I eventually got a security operations job in that group and just kind of went from there. So I did security operations for a few years and then moved up in some security engineering and, you know, built and deployed hundreds of IDS sensors and helped deploy and manage some SIMs and some other things like that. And then just kind of kept going from there.
I love the stories of how people got into security because, you know, you chemistry, I've heard English majors, I've heard outdoor leadership majors.
Yeah.
And really the common thread is curiosity, willingness to learn, you know, just that hunger for, okay, what's next, what's new. So very interesting. All right. Well, thank you for kind of walking us through like the evolution of a CISO role, the evolution of cybersecurity in general. But I've one final question for you.
All right.
The out of left field question for you. We always talk about security budgets. We're always talking about what do we do next, prioritizing, blah, 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 blah. If you had $50,000, maybe $100,000, I don't know what your budget is. If you had $50,000, where would you spend it to make the biggest impact to your organization?
Yeah, I think that there's definitely a couple areas that I would target for that. Most of the attacks that we see start today with end users. You know, it still is people being tricked for one way or another, phishing, you know, other means like that. And so I think I'd attack it a couple ways. One, you have to train people, make sure that they have an awareness of what they should be looking for, that they need to be skeptical when someone says that they're the CEO and they want you to buy gift cards because they left their wallet at home or whatever it is. And, you know, things that you should and shouldn't do, but then also good endpoint protection and response to make sure that when something does happen for people, usually that first entry is on someone's endpoint. So you need to be able to respond and protect against those sorts of things. And then also, you know, a lot of times it's the same way, it's based on password stealing and other kind of credential attacks. So putting MFA in place in as many places as you can is going to be one of those things that's really going to lift you up in a quick way.
You've probably outspent your budget times three right now, but let me go back to the kind of phishing, social engineering type stories. Cause
yeah.
you shared a story with me earlier of an example of, you need to do phishing attacks on your employees, but you need to do it right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think as part of that training, yes, you don't want to go overboard. I think, you know, starting easy and making sure people can detect very simple things is a good way to start, and then ramp things up, and then also then differentiate from there, right? For the people that get it, like, yeah, you can give them some harder stuff to see, test how they are, but you also don't want to just go so hard that everyone fails and that no one really learns anything. And then you also don't identify the people that need more help than others. But at a previous organization, we did a phishing test and we were trying to be really tricky. We were trying to see, okay, let's go hard and see if we can really get people and what are they going to do. And as part of that business, we did a lot of transactions via fax, and we would get faxes, e-faxes. So it would come to your email, and there was a, you know, pretty standard format that these looked like, and they all had an attachment. We thought, oh, well, okay, well, what if someone spoofed that? And so we sent out a phishing campaign that was basically a mirror copy of one of those eFax emails, but maybe very slight changes in things. And we got nearly everybody. Everybody fell for it because this was the thing that they got all the time. And after that, we started hearing from people that were like, yeah, well, part of that, even before then, my team was the one that got the phishing reports. So when someone thought an email was suspicious, they would report it to us and we'd investigate and let them know if it was good or bad. Well, we started getting all of these legitimate faxes that got reported to us because now people were afraid to just open any fax because they thought, oh, well, I don't know. Can I trust this anymore? Is this suspicious? I don't know. It looks like what I think it should look like, but I can't really tell. And so basically we made people afraid to do their jobs. And you don't want that either. It was a pretty low likelihood that someone would be able to spoof the way that we spoofed those facts, the fake fax message in the phishing test. And yeah, it could happen, but it was pretty low likelihood. And, you know, would it look exactly like what ours look like? Yeah, I mean, if someone could figure that out, they're probably going to be in the organization already and they're not going to do that. They're going to go some other way. So anyway, you just need to be careful about the tests that you do to make sure that it's really going to achieve the results that you want and not just make people over paranoid. It's good to have a healthy level of paranoia, but you don't want people to be so paranoid they can't do their job.
Yeah, definitely good advice and good learnings. Although I'm sure you guys patted yourself on the back like, wow, we came up with this at work.
That's right. We got everybody.
Yay.
Oops.
All right. Well, Alex, thank you so much for joining me. To all the listeners out there, join us next time for another episode of the Defenders Advantage Podcast Frontline Stories Series. Thank you.